And what an interesting topic. What an interesting guy. Rick Collingwood, international expert on hypnotism, what it can do for you, what it can't do for you, what you can do with it, what its limitations are, and how it could change your life here coming up shortly on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Rick Collingwood is a frequent guest on Coast to Coast, and you can also find out more about him by linking up with him at coasttocoastam.com, mindmotivations.com, Rick Collingwood's website. That's your official website, isn't it, Rick?
That's correct, Ian. How are you?
Good. It's a pleasure to have you back on again, especially when people are thinking about this time of year. You know, for the Christian calendar, this is a time of Advent, right? The end of old things and the beginning of new things. And a lot of people just look at that in terms of January is the time to make resolutions and try to change their life. But we also feel often very powerless about the choices that we are going to make. And we try to just do it through sheer willpower. And yet there's another power that's out there, and that's the power of hypnotism. So what's the success rate for people to use hypnotism on things like weight loss or the cessation of smoking?
Look, with a good hypnotist, it runs out at about 80% with a one-year follow-up. So a lot of it depends on the hypnotist that one were to choose to use as well. But the other thing is motivations. If you know, with our New Year's resolutions, we go, oh, yeah, this year I'll have another go at giving up smoking, but I don't really think it'll work. And the 1st or 2nd of January arrives and you quit for 4 or 5 hours or maybe
right.
a day, and then you're back onto it. So motivation is always of primary importance, whether hypnosis is involved or not, Ian.
Why does hypnosis wear off? If you've got hypnotized with post-hypnotic suggestions, why do they wear off?
Well, for about 20% of people, they won't, but only 20% of people will go down into those deep, deep hypnotic states where you can literally reprogram the subconscious mind. But when we have an issue, for example, like cigarette smoking, if you started when you were 15 and now you're 50 and you've decided that you're going to quit for whatever reason, you've got all the neural pathways burned in the brain, the state-dependent memories, the emotional triggers attached to it. And those things can come back and override after one single session of hypnosis. So anybody that says they can wave a wand and give a miracle cure in one session is either having themselves on or has just worked with lots and lots of somnambulists. So,
right.
You know, you have a whole lifetime of programs in your subconscious mind that all interlink, and they can become distorted rather quickly, you know, when you go back into the environment.
I keep forgetting to use that official term, somnambulist, right? That's what you are?
Somnambulist, yeah.
Somnambulist, right.
In the days of yore, they would call hypnotists somnambules. That was their official working title, if you will.
And that would be, if I'm looking at the word derivation, that would be sleepwalking people.
Exactly. In modern terms, when you go to the dictionary, it's somnambulism is sleepwalking. So they've pulled it away
right.
from a deep hypnotic state.
And so for you, though, I mean, as you look at helping people, what do you look for? Somebody comes in and says, yeah, I want you to hypnotize me because I want to stop eating so much chocolate. What do you look at for them before you even agree to try to hypnotize them?
Well, with eating, it's a different thing. It's very easy with the patterns of eating because you can override the desire to eat with a suggestion that you will eat a small portion and feel very full. And the person will literally take that on so they can't eat anymore. But if you were to use it, for example, with cigarette smoking, if you light up a cigarette and you're going to feel very sick or you're going to cough and cough and cough, those can be very inappropriate post-hypnotic suggestions. So it's difficult with an addictive substance such as a cigarette or nicotine, but with an action such as eating, whether it's for emotional purposes or whatever, you can use the physiology, the mind-body connection, to actually have the person feel much more full, even if they still wanted to eat. And it gets to the stage where you can only put so much water in a bucket. So it's different issues require different types of suggestion and post-hypnotic suggestion.
But what would be the clues you would look for in somebody that was walking into your office and saying, hey, I'd like to be hypnotized? What do you right away, what do you ask them? What do you do to try to ascertain whether or not this is going to be successful?
I ask them when the last time they went through the action was. For example, if someone, I don't sort of do one-on-one appointments for cigarette smokers anymore, but when I did, I would say, when did you have your last cigarette? And if they said, well, down at the door just before I came in, I'd say, well, we're making an appointment for this time next week. I don't want you to have a cigarette that morning because your commitment's not there. It's you need commitment from the person. They have to want to stop. So I could take somebody that was sent along by their husband or wife because cigarettes are too expensive now, and if they really wanted to keep smoking, after about a week or so, they'd be found in the out in the woodshed lighting up by their wife, you know what I mean? So
right.
With this, it's very important not to override free will.
Can you hypnotize somebody into becoming a smoker?
You could, definitely, yes. I've never tried it.
Has anybody ever asked you to say, I want you to hypnotize me because I want to start smoking?
No.
<Thank goodness. laughs> Wouldn't that be like really trippy?
I would probably be sending them away for a psychological evaluation, to be honest with you.
But what if they said, you know, I think smoking's really cool, and everybody I see on camera that smokes, I want to be like them. So, you know, go ahead, hypnotize me because I have all these health hang-ups. You know, I'm a really healthy person, but I really want to start smoking.
Look, maybe in hypnosis, get them to open their eyes and look at some pictures of smokers with amputated limbs or rotten lungs and livers, and that would certainly turn the cool component down pretty quick, I think.
I guess so. So what won't you hypnotize somebody then for doing? Let's say they come in and they say, I have a low, and I know you don't do a lot of the sort of garden variety stuff, but just work with me on this, that you had somebody come into you and say, look, I have a very low libido, and I have a lot of hangups about travel. So, I mean, what kind of thing would you do and what would you not do?
Look, I would do anything that is the human condition or any challenge that we have, but I wouldn't work with somebody who was diagnosed with a significant mental health disorder such as schizophrenia or multiple personality disorder or what have you, because that's a field of mental health expertise. So basically any challenge that a person has that they're faced with that they either want to improve or get rid of, I'm quite comfortable to work with people. So, and some people come in and go, can you just put me into trance and tell me this relevant to the issue? And, you know, a psychologist might say, well, that's not right because there could be deeper issues. But to my way of thinking, if a sane person walks into a clinic and knows what they want, there's nothing wrong with giving them the feedback that they've fed to you first, because you'll usually get a pretty good result with it.
We're talking with Rick Collingwood, expert on hypnosis and hypnotherapy. So that means, if I'm going to read you right, where someone's going to come in and say, help me understand a traumatic experience that happened when I was a teenager.
Yes.
They would say, it happened sometime when I was 13 and I was in the woods on a camping trip, and I can't remember what it did, but I know that my life has forever been changed from when I went out in the woods that night.
Okay. Now, if somebody's looking for something and you put them into hypnosis, you can bet your bottom dollar they're going to find something. Now, what they find might not necessarily be the truth. For example, the subconscious will remember it, but it can remember a toy that was very, very special to you when you were 5 years old that now has no relevance whatsoever. So it can distort its own belief and emotional patterns as well. If somebody suspected that an incident has been repressed that happened to them, I would put them into trance, and using what we call finger signals, I would directly ask the subconscious mind if anything had happened, and it would respond either one tap for yes and two for no. After that, if it said yes, something had happened, I would ask it to detach the emotional residue of that incident from the subconscious mind and the body mind, so that the person can move forward free of the anxiety or whatever the attachment were that it was causing in the present time. So once it agrees to do that, it will do that. I'm not big on regression therapy. It's never really been proven, and it's a field of expertise. And usually, when you regress people, they'll go and find something.
So when you say regression therapy, that would be then, say, just to use the example, people that use hypnotism to re-examine what they think of as being a UFO encounter or something like that. You wouldn't do that?
No, I wouldn't, because there's a lady in Australia who's an expert with that, and I would refer the person off to them. But look, I think a lot of those regressions, it's interesting. You can watch Leading Questions. It's not where are you, it's what spaceship are you on, and it's not what's happening, it's what are the aliens doing to you. Now, that doesn't mean that I discredit these alien abductions, because I don't. I've spent time with Roger Lear, one of the doctors that's found the little rice-size implants in people in hospitals. But a lot of it is sort of commercialized. You can talk anyone into thinking anything's happened to them, and you've got 10 minutes with them, you know.
Those in chaplaincy, I don't know how you would call this, but in working with people in kind of spiritual crisis, we call those dirty questions.
Yeah.
You got to ask clean questions if you want a clean answer, and the dirty questions are ones that are smudged with the opinion or the agenda of the asker.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when you're doing that kind of work, if you have the person, the client, in an emotional state, there's no clear thinking there at all. They're going to find one road to walk down, and they're going to keep going down that road regardless of whether it appears to be a load of nonsense or quite real. So I think these therapies, or using hypnosis in these therapies, does take a lot of care and a lot of expertise.
Where are you then on past life regression hypnotherapy, where people try to find those things that they think happened to them, in another go around on the planet?
Absolutely amazing and very therapeutical experiences. I've had one myself that I found completely on the net, which was quite astounding to me. I've had somebody in a training class speak basically forgotten Latin, with the linguistics department of the university saying, who can speak this language? This is astounding. But my professional take on it is, nobody ever bought a DVD back from God yet. But common sense says there's something quite profound going on. I've also spent a lot of time working with cancer, and as people are passing, some strange things happen sometimes. So I don't have any issues personally on whether we continue on or not, because I think that we do. But that's a personal belief, which doesn't have any scientific basis to it, you know?
Well, you know, actually, there's more and more science on that. I think that's a fair – I mean, I know why you said that, because you're just sounding objective, but – I would have said 10 years ago, there's very little science on that. There's more and more hospital academic research going on these after-death experiences that are stunning.
And they're getting braver and slowly letting the information out too, which is a wonderful thing. I've seen some incredible healings happen by putting people into past life regressions and not even talking about the issue they're carrying at the present time. And it just resolves itself and goes away. So even if we didn't continue on after this life, a good past life regression therapist can bring about some amazing transformations for people. It's
and
quite
that,
extraordinary.
That would be identifying, say, a current hitch that somebody might have on something to find out through past life regression hypnotherapy that hitch they're having in their modern life, their current life, goes back to something they had experienced in an ancient life?
I think so. And with consciousness, we're talking about an energy form, which is timelessness, which is timeless. It's not locked in the third dimensional body we're in. For example, this guy that I was saying was speaking this Latin, he found himself lying in a field at 24 years old with a sword in his lower back and buttercups tickling his nose as he passed. He'd had lower back problems since he was 12 and was on painkillers every day. After that experience, the painkillers, he was just experienced no more pain. So it's extraordinary. But we didn't go searching for that. It was an observation he made during this regression.
That he died as a Roman soldier with a sword in his back in a field somewhere.
Yeah. And I'll never forget, he said, oh, there's all these little yellow buttercups tickling my nose. It was quite extraordinary.
And one would, I've always, you know, there's a lot that's been written about it more poetically or in fiction, but I've always wondered about that. Those last few sensations you'd have, those last few ironic thoughts you might have as one is fading out on this earth. And I would imagine that if I were a soldier dying in a field somewhere, the smell of grass or the look of a bug climbing up a stem of something, that might be your last thought as you're laying there with nobody to talk to and just slowly fading as your life energy is running out of your body.
Wouldn't it be a powerful impression?
Yeah. So in terms of hypnotherapy then, when somebody goes in, I mean, even smoking might be an evidence of something that happened in a past life where something so, I don't know, something so anxiety causing is unresolved from a past life and is causing them to seek that through an oral fixation or an emphasis in their life on chemical dependency like nicotine.
It could well be. I wouldn't, for a smoker, I wouldn't use a past life tense as such, but I usually work with smoking via direct suggestion. It's the depth of trance that becomes important for cigarette smokers, for addictive behaviors, whether it be marijuana, heroin, or cigarettes. It's all just using one thing to cover up something else, and then it becomes a habit, and one gets stuck in that rut, so to speak.
What about hypnotherapy and alcoholism?
It's been very, very successful. The greatest studies done on that actually were on Polish alcoholics with Hitler's hypnotist, a fellow by the name of Ogisi. He was a mesmerist as well, and Hitler picked him up. He said, I can put lions to sleep and I can put bears to sleep. So Hitler told someone from the SS, take him to the zoo and throw him in a lion cage. And he had this lion in a deep trance in under a minute, and then they put him in the bear's cage. Now, I don't know what else Hitler used him for, because his book is, I think there's a lot of information left, but they're working with alcoholics, and they've got 50 alcoholics, and they used aversion therapy and hypnosis as well, and they got quite astounding results with them.
I'm stunned that there's never been a History Channel episode called Hitler's Hypnotist, which I think would be awesome.
Wouldn't it?
But then I'm curious whether if you had the lion under a post-hypnotic suggestion, could you tell the lion to be a bear and tell the bear to be a lion?
What they were using, I'm holding the book right now. It's a very old one, Hypnosis of Man and Animals. It was printed in the 40s, but there's photographs in there of this fellow in the bear cage and the lion's cage. But he used... mesmerism and hypnotic fascination, which I've actually just been studying for the last couple of months, are the hypnotic fascination aspects of it, which is more energy work than direct suggestion. So that's where the look into my eyes first came
right.
from. So there's various aspects of or different types of hypnosis, Ian. So, you know, a lot of going along to the clinical hypnotherapist is pick a spot on the wall, close your eyes and just relax and go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. Those people get into a nice alpha state, but that's not hypnosis. Hypnosis is the frequency, the brain frequency of theta, which is one state
right.
under. So a lot of what's being called hypnotism isn't hypnotism per se anymore. It doesn't mean it's not effective, but it's not traditional hypnotism.
I know there's a lot of people that say it's really easy to hypnotize a chicken, right? All you have to do is hold a chicken and then you... It will focus on your finger, and you draw your finger out to a certain point, and the chicken will automatically fall asleep, focusing on the point where you've drawn your finger. And I've seen this done on videos, and it's pretty remarkable. I mean, I don't know if that counts as hypnotism. I don't know whether you could hypnotize a chicken into believing it's another kind of chicken or something, or hypnotize a hen to think it's a rooster, but it is kind of cool. You can see those videos on YouTube. Talking with Rick Collingwood, expert on hypnotism and hypnotherapy. And we'll get into more of this coming up just a second. What you can and can't do with yourself. Is it possible to hypnotize yourself? And or when you're doing a group therapy, can you hypnotize a group to do the exact same thing at the exact same time? And when would that be ethical? Because I have a suggestion on that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Rick Collingwood, hypnotherapist, expert on the limitations and the unexplored horizons of hypnotherapy and hypnotism. And we'll talk about group hypnotism and what you can do with yourself and what you can't do next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, you know, I am curious about hypnotism. I may actually, for the first time, Rick, pursue a hypnotherapist for something in the coming year. And I've
Good.
been thinking about it for a very long time because I was actually sort of raised with a kind of a prejudice against hypnotism. In particular, you know, some of the abuses of hypnotism have kind of also put me off a little bit over the years. And you know what I mean by that. I'm not talking about you,
Yeah,
but there've been,
I understand.
right, there's been plenty of people who have done some things and ended up doing more damage than they did good for somebody in that state. So before I do that, what could I do by myself in terms of hypnotism? How far can we go, you know, through you know, the kind of osmosis types of hypnotism by running, you know, tapes at our bedside at night and that kind of thing? What can we do with that?
Look, we can, it, without it, without any assistance whatsoever, I can lie down very quickly and have my body with no feeling in it. You could come up and poke me with a broken glass or whatever you wanted, and I wouldn't be able to feel it. But in hypnosis, what we're doing is we're taking the conscious reality testing out of the left brain into the right brain, and you can't maintain a full consciousness doing that. So therefore, what I'm saying is you can't give yourself any instructions. Once you get yourself into a deep hypnotic state, you would fall asleep. CDs, tapes, what have you, they will work very fine, but some work better than others.
You
Mine
have
are one
yours.
of
You have yours though, right? Yours are on your website, right?
Yeah, they've been around a long time now. They've won a lot of awards, but they have a special frequency in the background that guarantees that the listener is going to go down into a deep trance state and get an effect from the program. They're not as effective, of course, as going to a good skilled hypnotherapist in a one-on-one session, but they cost a tremendous amount less, and you can use them as often as what you want. But the media have tested them on TV and all over the place. They come out at about 80% successful, so they're very, very powerful.
And what I've been to your website, but I didn't go through the catalog. What is available on MP3, et cetera,
Now
from your
you've
website?
got me, mate. There's 53 different titles now.
Tell me, but I mean it. Like,
Look,
what do you recommend?
there's weight loss, there's personal life motivation, there's PTSD, fear of flying, fingernail biting, quitting smoking, of course. There's a new range now for children. We've been experimenting with this frequency with autism in the US with Autism Speaks and having some phenomenal results with the children's range with this frequency in the background. We've had children that have never uttered a word in 7 years come out of a bedroom and walk up to a father and go, "Morning, Daddy," and had never spoken a word. There's some pretty
Wow.
extraordinary things, but a lot of that is coming from
Wow.
the frequency. So these are very exciting tests we're doing. They don't cure autism, of course, but they really bring autistic children. They balance them emotionally and make them want to socialize. And in the case of nonverbal autism, they are doing something in the brain to synchronize the hemispheres, if you will, that are enabling children to get a grasp on language and to use it, which is extraordinary. So
And I'm assuming insomnia is on the list.
insomnia is definitely on the list.
Like,
Look,
is
that's one thing with the testimonials that come through on the website. There's hundreds of testimonials, and people say the side effect from all any CD is a brilliant night's sleep. And once again, that's the frequency that's doing it. It's
okay.
I've been interested in frequency for 25 years, and because everything is a frequency, and if you get the right pitch and the right tone, and present it perfectly with the correct pacing, you can get phenomenal results from it.
I may do that tonight. I may go ahead and grab some of those because I'm really curious. Actually, when you went through the list of some of the things, I'm going, me. So I don't know how many I'll do tonight, but I would definitely do insomnia. And I don't sleep well, and I'm frequently tired, but I just can't get to sleep. So there's kind of a weird mental jump for me,
The
I think.
ruminating of the mind just keeps
Yeah.
going around and
Yeah,
around and
mind
around.
chatter, as the Buddhists call it.
Yes. Well, we can calm that down very easily with hypnosis. But just as an aside, I'm back in the US for training all of March, and I've got a couple of weeks up my sleeve. So perhaps through the email, we might
Oh, I'd love
talk
that.
about a visit you.
Oh, I would love that. I would totally love that. And
Well,
what I'll
that's.
do is I'll try some of these first and just to get a feel for it, and go from there. Ordinarily, when you work with groups, Do you do group hypnosis?
I do. I've just been through Victoria, actually, doing groups for quit smoking, between sort of 60 and 250 people. But the largest I ever did was 1,200 people in a big auditorium in Brisbane. And that's when I first began to learn about the energetics of resonating human energy fields, and to watch that wave go across 1,000 people and send them down into a deep trance. And it's the same energy that will make 1,000 starlings turn in the sky and not bang into each other.
Oh, that's so cool.
But you could actually see this effect go across the top of people. It was like a shimmer from on a hot road with the sun out. It was extraordinary, and the results were phenomenal. And then it makes it very easy to understand how a charismatic person can turn a whole country against the world, or lift themselves into an esteemed position that they don't really deserve to have or don't have the skills to fulfill.
Well, you know what? That's sort of a subtext of the question about group therapy, which is that it seems like that would be something that somebody who's skilled in that art would be able to manipulate when it came to, say, the rise of somebody powerful like Adolf Hitler. And so you brought him up earlier. What was so hypnotic about Adolf Hitler? What did he do so well that got, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands, then millions of people entranced with his message?
Everybody else being entranced by him initially, and then it becomes the accepted way things are. I was in Germany 2 years ago at Anton Mesmer's, visiting his monument, and I met an old fellow, a German guy, and he said to me that when he was a boy, he can remember going to Hitler rallies, and he hated Hitler for the ethos of Hitler. He said, but when the guy came past, you couldn't help but look at him and follow him with your eyes, and you couldn't break it. But the energy is building up because there's another 500,000 people there doing the same thing, and we go into that herd mentality. And our thoughts can be easily affected, especially with emotion. Like, you look at the way, for example, he's not the right guy to be talking about, but Hitler with a Sieg Heil, and everybody right. would do the same thing. And it just imprints this pattern within us that becomes, we accept it as the way things are. And then we can basically be manipulated into doing anything in a very short space of time. So one of the keys for manipulation is to create an emotional state in somebody and then give them a way out by following your direction.
But when you're doing that, then you also have to I imagine there's a lot of working parts to that. You have to have the right message. You have to have the right. There have been other people who have tried that, but they couldn't come up with the right meme. They couldn't come up with. Right.
Look, have you seen this? Do they have on this a series called Lie to Me?
No. US? Tell me about that.
It's about subtle body language. It's a company that it's obviously not a true story, but it's based on some truisms. A company that brings psychologists in that look for minute little aspects of body language, like there's certain subconscious fixtures and movements our face will make, or our hands will make, or our pupils will dilate. And these people are trained to observe this and to know whether we're telling a lie. And the reason that's there is by the time we're 2 years old, we've already subconsciously picked up 130 subtle body language cues that we will react and not react to. If you want to be a powerful person in your own essence, just try this. Practice not blinking. You look at any good actor, watch TV, watch the news, watch someone who's a very charismatic actor, they don't blink much. Subconsciously, if we're in the presence of somebody not blinking much, we might not even realize they're not, but subconsciously there's that little urge that they have some kind of a charisma or some kind of power, but we can't quite put our finger on it. Whereas if people are very nervous, they'll blink very rapidly, and then subconsciously we'll pick up something's not quite right here.
Why is it that some women, I'll use women as an example, but I know this is also true for men, but why is it that some women have a greater sex appeal than their, you know, they have their whole is greater than the sum of their parts, if you will, where we used to call it the musk. Where you just tell, like, somebody just had this sort of sexiness about them. But when you actually broke it down on graph paper, there wasn't anything extraordinary about them, but there was just something really sort of sexy about them. And you can't, it's sort of an indefinable character. Any thought on that?
Yeah, look, that's because they feel that way within themselves. and it expresses out in the waveform. You know, every cell in your body has a tiny, tiny little amount of magnetite, and it picks up the energy forms of other individuals that are close by you. This is how mesmerism works, and it's scientifically established now. So if you're holding a thought very strongly or a belief very strongly, your body will represent that thought. So, for example, if somebody's depressed and having a bad day, their shoulders will be down, they'll be walking along all droopy. If somebody has a great life and lives in the present and thinks that they're sexy and charismatic, and that becomes a belief, that's how other people will perceive them. Whereas if someone's trying to do it as an act or because they think they have to at that time, but they're not really that way, it won't come across as genuine. A lot of what we're picking up is tiny little subconscious cues and emotional beliefs that come through the waveform.
You mentioned before a couple of times now mesmerism. And was it Anton or Otto Mesmer? I can't remember.
It was Franz Anton Mesmer, but he called himself Anton in his final years. There's a lot of incorrect history about Mesmer. I've spent the last 10 years researching every piece of information that I can about him. He was an astronomer. He followed the work of the astronomer Richard Meade, and he said that was an effect of the planets on the body, which was affecting the energy field, which is true. We know what the moon does. He also studied the work of Paracelsus. Paracelsus had been with the Egyptian temple masters and the sleep masters, which is where what we call hypnotic fascination comes from, this look into my eyes. And I've been working with that for 6 months now. I was at training this morning, and I could literally walk up to a person, put my hand beside their head. Then I had a lawyer who was fighting me for all he was worth, and in 35 seconds, they just go into a complete stupor. And I got this guy by the shoulder and rocked him backwards and forwards gently and went tick-tock, tick-tock, walked away. And for 45 minutes, the guy was just there swaying and couldn't remember a thing about it. So, you know, we can also, once we know how to do it, you can affect the animal nature of our brain, which is where all the receptors are and our instincts, if you will. And it's very easy to override when you know how to do it. And this stuff is basically a forgotten art that I'm working quite strongly with at the moment to bring back, because I think it's a quintessential part of all healing, you know?
Yeah, actually, now that I remember, too, I said Otto Mesmer. That's the guy who invented Felix the Cat.
So, that was Otto Mesmer.
That's Otto Mesmer, not Anton. That's why I was getting confused in my head. But that is the interesting. So that's something fairly ancient, because he was 19th century, right? He was Civil War era.
18th century.
Oh, was he even that far back?
Yeah, so, he died in the 19th century.
Okay, but I remember reading about him and sort of everybody had this sort of there's some sort of a Rasputin-like reputation he had for having this power, and people were very scared, or at least in some of the readings I had, they're kind of scared of him that he had, because he just seemed so otherworldly, powerful, like a wizard.
Yeah, he had studied the gaps between our consciousness and our desire for the future and our fear from the past, and he came forward to live in the present. But there's some amazing documented factual things that he did. Where he passed away in Meersburg, there's a lake there called Lake Constance. And on Lake Constance is an island called Mainau, where the royalty lived. And the royalty had ordered a lot of canaries. They liked birds. So these canaries on this island couldn't escape because it was too far to fly. And there's a lot of writings whenever Mesmer went there by invitation, all the birds on the island would just flock around him and wouldn't leave him alone. And one hopped on the boat and rode back with him one day, and there's the story of his magnetizable canary. Now, he could hold it in his hand. It would sing to him. He could stroke it from tail to head, and it would die and would have no vital signs at all, and then stroke from head to tail, and it would come alive and begin to sing again. It died 2 days after he passed away. I think it pined for him and joined him in the other world. But there were some extraordinary things he did. The historians say that he got thrown out of France. He wasn't thrown out, because he wrote a letter to Marie Antoinette saying, "I will leave in August because I have too many patients. It's a shame that your academic doctors are trying to destroy the greatest healing force the world's ever known." Then he went to Meersburg and treated the sick for free. And then a doctor by the name of Karl Wolfart came down from the German Academy of Sciences, and they took him to Berlin, and he didn't really want to go. He walked in and he said, who is in charge of the academy, and this fellow put his hand out, and he threw his hand towards him, a power towards him, and struck him to the floor and lifted him up and put him down again 19 times, documented in front of a lot of witnesses, before they said, hey, we want to use this stuff. We're not going to make a fool of you. So he was a very powerful man, but what he had done was he had learned how to switch on the naturally occurring receptors that we all have that we don't know we've got.
Well, that's Anton Mesmer. We're talking with Rick Collingwood, and that's the kind of stories I would hear about him. That he's spoken of like he's almost like Merlin, or that he had some power that nobody could account for, and that there were a lot of witnesses to his power, but just nobody was quite certain where they came from. Now we would say we know more about where his power comes from.
And look, a lot of it can be scientifically measured and demonstrated. Now, his big problem was he said, there's an ethereal fluid that comes down from the heavens and I control it. Well, it was cosmic energy. No one ever disputed the healings that he did. He did thousands of healings. There was a Dr. James Esdale took his work and went to work in India with it. And they never spoke a word in mesmerism. There was no word spoken. And he did 1,700 documented limb amputations using mesmerism. There was never any pain. And his post-surgical mortality rate using mesmerism in India, which wasn't the cleanest place, was 5%, whereas conventional medicine for the same operations was running at around 50%. So this wasn't all imagination and wishful thinking. There's something very profound in the energy field happening underneath, which has been completely discarded from hypnosis. With my students, I tell them, you need to have an intention to heal your client. If you're just doing this as a process to get $180 an hour, you're not going to be very successful. So you're really stealing people's money, you know. And that's my belief. You do have to have a desire for the person to make the shift they're looking for.
Well, and when this doctor in India did these amputations, he used mesmerism to put them into a state where he did the physical amputations, or he used mesmerism to cut off the limbs?
To put them in the state.
Okay.
Like once they were in a
like anesthesia.
State. In a mesmeric state. In a mesmeric state, you're completely anesthetized. And you have an inability to remember anything afterwards. It's quite extraordinary. There's some documents. One of his writings, it was a Sunday, and they brought an Indian fellow in. He said he had a large tumor in his throat that was stopping him from sleeping. He was afraid his breathing wouldn't work. He said he was a rather hard fellow to mesmerize. It took me 20 minutes. And upon doing that, I got my scalpel. I cut a hole under the cheek. And then I drilled a small hole below the jawbone and stuck my fingers up into the sinus area, and the anterior maxillae collapsed, and a horrible, shocking gush of gray matter and putridity came spewing forth. And I scraped the tumor for half an hour with my finger and then laid the fellow on the floor and sewed him up. And he came back 2 days later and had no memory of the operation, but he came back to thank Esdale because he was sleeping so well. There was other teams of doctors. He had to ban pins from being in his surgeries because doctors would come from the UK and the US, and they would look at what he was doing and they'd get their pins out and want to poke these people that were mesmerized to ensure that they were in some kind of a non-responsive state. So one of the first things that happens in mesmerism is the ability to fear. It has natural anesthesia with it.
Okay. Hang on a second. I want to know more about it. Rick Collingwood. And you coming up next. We're going to give you the numbers. I will just say I have a lot more questions for Rick Collingwood, so I'll try to intersperse those along the way next hour while you get in on the conversation as well coming up on Coast to Coast on hypnotism, on hypnotherapy, about what it is that you're struggling with, how hypnotism might work for you. And remember, tomorrow night, it's all about money laundering and offshore banking, having a Swiss bank account. How successful is it? What does the government know? What does the government allow? How is it changing? You'll hear more about that. The secret world of secret banking, Sunday night on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.